Hendrix used his mastery of guitar and studio techniques to create 1983, a science fiction fantasy that firmly established him as a composer.
Hooray, I awake from yesterday.
And I'm very happy, very, very sorry to have to step on this very beautiful music, but unfortunately, I don't even know what happened at 5 o'clock, but 5 o'clock was not here until well after the 5 o'clock hour. Nonetheless, we begin the morning show and encourage you to tune in next week for From the Vault. Brother, hustling other, trying to make ends meet. Very, very important to get that part of the song out. I know the music and the guitar licks and the bass licks sound good, but hearing that message is oh so important, I believe, anyway. 6:02, 6:03, actually, on a Monday morning here in New York City, the 16th day of November 2016. 2016, 2015. It will be 2016, and we'll be here right along with you, but we're a little bit ahead of ourselves right now. 2015 here in New York City. I'm Michael G. Haskins, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. Jed Brandt is not with me this morning. He's going to be away for a few weeks, and then he'll be back with us. Looking forward to him returning. We have a wonderful program for you this morning. A number of things we'll be sharing with you. In fact, a really fine piece from the United Nations. Sally O'Brien and some folks at the United Nations put together this really quite extraordinary piece about Black Lives Matter. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in this hour. Of course, the world, here in France, are reeling from the horrific events that happened on Friday. We'll talk about that with Bob Henley somewhat in the 7 o'clock hour. Also in the 7 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Kevin Powell. He's the author of a brand new book, and want to share a whole lot more information with you about that. Jeannie Hopper will be joining me in the 7 o'clock hour about that as well, so we're looking forward to that. I don't have a Samori Benjamin sports report for you this week, but I do have continuing the serialized reading of Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. We have another installment that we want to bring. Actually, it's chapter two. Chapter two, we'll share that with you. So all of that and more. But first things first, as usual, as always, we have news with Linda Perry.
Good morning. Here's some of the news for Monday morning, November 16, 2015. On Friday evening, gunmen and bombers attacked restaurants, a concert hall, and a sports stadium at locations across Paris. This left 129 dead, 99 in critical condition, and more than 300 wounded. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the attacks.
C'est un acte de guerre qui a été commis par une armée terroriste, Daesh, une armée djihadiste contre la France, contre les valeurs que nous défendons partout dans le monde.
French President François Hollande promised swift retaliation for what he called an act of war, acts of terrorism and barbarism.
C'est un acte de guerre qui a été préparé, organisé, planifié de l'extérieur et avec des complicités intérieures que l'enquête permettra d'établir. C'est un acte d'une barbarie absolue.
On Sunday, President Obama reiterated what he had said right after the attacks, that the U.S. stands with France.
The killing of innocent people based on a twisted ideology is an attack not just on France, not just on Turkey, but it's an attack on the civilized world.
On Sunday evening, France launched airstrikes on Raqqa. That's what the Islamic State group has been using as its capital in Syria. It's located on the north bank of the Euphrates River. The French Ministry of Defense said they destroyed a jihadi training camp and a munitions dump. Iraqi intelligence say that's where Friday's attack on Paris was planned. The jets were launched from sites in Jordan and the Persian Gulf in coordination with U.S. forces. An ISIS-affiliated website confirmed the strikes on the center of the city, saying 10 people had been killed and dozens wounded. It also published photographs purportedly showing victims, including two of young boys, suggesting that they were civilians. Across the U.S., vigils were held in solidarity with the people of France. In Washington Square Park, people gathered over the weekend to talk about the attacks.
Well, my thoughts are very sad, and I feel very, very afraid of the world that we are living in.
Marie-Jill Engel is a retired French teacher.
I was very shocked that you two, for example, canceled the concert. I think we all have to keep living the way we have and not let anybody intimidate us. And I think this rally here is wonderful just because there is so much respect. And obviously, you know, people are not loud, people are in pain, and it's just a wonderful sense of community.
Some point out that when there are attacks like this in non-Western countries, they don't get the same amount of attention. For instance, in April, at least 147 people, mostly students, were killed in an assault by al-Shabaab militants on a university in northeastern Kenya. Witnesses said the militants singled out Christians and shot them. Al-Shabaab says it attacked the university because it is at war with Kenya. Meanwhile, in the aftermath of the Paris attacks, people all over the world and belonging to all faiths have reiterated that the blame for growing international conflict cannot be put on Muslims or people belonging to the Islamic faith. And on Sunday, President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed Syria's civil war. This was on the sidelines of the G20 economic summit in Turkey. The U.S. administration says Obama and Putin agreed that Syria needs a political transition led by Syrians, preceded by negotiations mediated by the U.N. and a ceasefire. Obama and Putin have long been at odds about whether there's a role for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad after the transition. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Ne me quitte pas, il faut oublier tout. Souliers qui s'enfuient déjà, oublier le temps des malentendus et le temps perdu, à savoir comment oublier ces heures qui tuaient parfois à coup de pourquoi le cœur du bonheur ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Moi, je t'affirmais des perles de pluie, venues de
will ne plus pas. Je creuserai la terre jusqu'après ma mort pour couvrir ton corps d'or et de lumière. Je ferai en demain où l'amour sera roi, où l'amour sera loi, où tu seras reine. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Ne me quitte pas, je t'inventerai des mots insensés que tu comprendras. Je te parlerai de ces amants-là qui ont vu deux fois le cœur s'embraser. Je te raconterai l'histoire de ce roi mort de n'avoir pas pu te rencontrer. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. On a vu souvent rejaillir le feu de l'ancien volcan qu'on croyait trop vu. Il est paru-t-il des terres brûlées dans le plus de blé qu'en meilleur avril. Et combien le soir au conciel flamboie, le rouge et le noir ne s'épousent-ils pas. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Je me cacherai là à te regarder danser et sourire et à t'écouter chanter et puis rire. Laisse-moi devenir l'ombre de ton ombre, l'ombre de ta main, l'ombre de ton chien. Ne me quitte pas.
Nina Simone. It almost brings tears to my eyes. I mean, it makes me shudder about halfway through this piece. Ne me quitte pas, don't leave me. In fact, the originator, well, I don't know if he's the originator, but the individual who made this song quite popular, we'll hear that in the 7 o'clock hour right after the news. He actually breaks down. I mean, the tears are running down this boy's face. I said, this boy's face. Excuse me, this man's face. And it is quite an emotional tribute. Don't leave me. As I'm thinking about when I heard this. This is not the first time I heard this, but it made me think about the death in Paris, France, over the past weekend that started on Friday. So I started things out with that piece, Ne me quitte pas, by Nina Simone. This is the morning show on radio station WBAI. By the way, it is 54 degrees, a little bit warmer than I expected on the 16th day of November 2015. Where did I get 2016 from? I guess anticipating the future. That's a good thing. But it's 2015. And it is November 16th. And as we usually do, we start off this day in history. And on this date in history, November 16th, 1928, an obscenity trial began for Radcliffe Hall's novel, The Well of Loneliness. Great Britain banned it for its treatment of lesbianism, though it contained no explicit sexual references. A U.S. court in 1929 ruled similarly for its sympathetic portrait of homosexuality and because it, quote, pleads for tolerance on the part of society, unquote. Also on this date in 1989, six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter were brutally murdered by U.S.-trained and supported death squads in El Salvador. In 1995, the United Nations Commission on the Truth for El Salvador linked the slayings to 19 members of the armed forces who were graduates of the School of the Americas, SOA, now known as Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, a facility run by the U.S. Army at Fort Benning, Georgia. For its 59 years, the SOA has trained over 60,000 Latin American soldiers in counterinsurgency techniques, sniper commando and psychological warfare, military intelligence, and interrogation tactics. The graduates have consistently used their skills to wage a war against their own people. And finally, on this date in history, November 16th, 1994. After receiving assurances from the United States, Britain, and France, the Ukrainian Parliament approved Ukraine's agreement to follow the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty as a non-nuclear weapons state. And that wraps up this date in history for November 16th. And it's 16 minutes past the hour of 6 o'clock. Good morning, everybody, and how are you doing? I had hoped that by mid-November we would be able to have you join us. Those of you listening throughout our area would be able to have you join us on the phone for some conversation and catching up. It's been a long time since we've been able to catch up with you and talk about some of the things that are happening in your lives, in your neighborhood, in your community, and what's going on around the world. Certainly, as we look and respond to the horrific situation that happened in Paris on Friday, and now bombs are falling in Syria, and so there will be certainly reverberations around that. Would like to talk to you, but not yet, but soon come. As they say, soon come. It'll happen soon enough. But we have a number of things that we want to share throughout the rest of this hour. As I said, we're going to be revisiting or going back to the incidents in the life of a slave girl by Linda Brent. And it was the thing that's really noteworthy about this when I read the book initially was that it was the account was by a woman, by a young slave girl at the time. And when she finally liberated herself, she wrote this down. And, you know, we hear a lot of slave narratives, but hearing it from a woman's vantage point, from her eyes, from her experience, I think is quite noteworthy. So what I did when we were at WHCR, I asked several of the women at WBAI if they'd like to participate in a serialized reading, and several of them did, and we're ongoing with that process. She'll be doing that in just a bit. Before that, however, we want to share some information about what's going on here at the station, and I encourage you to stay tuned. We're in the middle of the dial, and we are a commercial-free and a listener-supported station. And we'll be right back with that piece that I mentioned just a moment ago.
We are Refining Faith, and we listen to WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM.
Ooh. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Nina Simone, thank you. Thank you, people. We are a commercial-free and listener-sponsored radio station, just concluded last Sunday, in fact, our membership drive here at WBAI, and we thank you so much for your ongoing support of this commercial-free station. Discrimination against people of African descent remains a significant problem in many parts of the world. That's the reality underlying a special event at UN headquarters November the 3rd. That happened, Confronting the Silence, Perspectives and Dialogue on Structural Racism Against People of African Descent Worldwide. The meeting, held in the UN's Economic and Social Council, was one of a series of events being held to mark the International Decade for People of African Descent. We have two reports this morning, first from UN Radio's Matthew Wells, followed by Sally O'Brien of WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York.
Colonialism and slavery took an especially heavy toll on Africans and their descendants. And today, in many countries around the world, racial discrimination continues to disproportionately affect them, the meeting heard. Several UN organizations took part in the event, along with church members, Amnesty International, and representatives from the US-based group Black Lives Matter. Over the past year, Black Lives Matter has received national attention and become a potent political force, in the face of ongoing cases of mainly white police officers killing or injuring unarmed African Americans. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayd Raad al-Hussein, outlined the different forms of routine discrimination faced by many Africans.
People of African descent are also victims of hate crimes and Afrophobia. Communities of African descent are often also poor and marginalized, with higher rates of maternal mortality and limited access to economic opportunities or quality education, health services, housing, and social security.
Some speakers pointed out that the US was not alone in failing to treat citizens of African descent equally. One academic said that in Brazilian society, for example, many had suffered similar discrimination. Matthew Wells, United Nations.
While the UN panel discussion was intended to cover racism against African people worldwide, for many in the packed ECOSOC chamber, the focus centered on racism against black people in the United States. Following keynote speeches, including one from UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador and renowned singer Harry Belafonte, the UN Special Rapporteur on Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance, Mutuma Rutere, discussed the impact of, quote, counterterrorism on people of color and migrants.
Profiling is prevalent in everyday law enforcement practices, but it is also worth highlighting that the issue is arising at the moment with regard to policies connected to national security and immigration. Different patterns of racial and ethnic profiling have surfaced in recent years as states have taken measures to counter terrorism. Migrants and minority groups have been particularly susceptible to the adverse effects of these new law enforcement practices. Official border crossings and hubs of transportation, such as airports, railway stations, and bus depots, have been common places where racial and ethnic profiling takes place. I am also concerned about the development of new technologies that purport to create risk profiles for specific ethnic groups. Use of this software by law enforcement agencies has generated fears that racial and ethnic profiling may become a regularized and permanent fixture of immigration and border control management systems around the world. Profiling in the administration of justice has often led to unjust and disproportionate punishment of individuals of traditionally discriminated groups, and in particular, people of African descent. This discrimination is partly enabled by high levels of discretionary powers in the administration of criminal justice systems. In some contexts, this practice has been intensified by indirect discrimination, where criminalization and harsher punishment related to certain kinds of recreational drugs have disproportionately affected minorities. I cannot emphasize enough that racial and ethnic profiling is prohibited under international human rights law, as this practice violates multiple human rights, including the right to live free from discrimination, the right to equality before the law, the right to personal freedom and security, and the right to presumption of innocence. The International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination prohibits the use of racial profiling. The General Equality Provision of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights also covers questions of profiling, as do specific guarantees prohibiting racial discrimination relating to the right to liberty and security of person, the right against arbitrary arrest or detention, and the right to liberty. I have recommended that states gather law enforcement data, including statistics disaggregated by ethnicity and race, which are essential in order to prove the existence and the extent of racial and ethnic profiling. Furthermore, investigative oversight bodies should have the authority to address allegations of racial and ethnic profiling and make practical recommendations for policy changes. Finally, I call for the effective regulation of discretionary powers of law enforcement personnel in order to reduce the risk of racial and ethnic profiling.
The panel discussion followed, beginning with Gay McDougall, member of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. McDougall spoke of some of the UN initiatives worldwide.
In its general recommendation number 34, adopted by CERD in 2011, on racial discrimination against people of African descent, the UN committee recognized that racism and structural discrimination against people of African descent, rooted in the infamous regime of slavery, are evident in the situations of inequality affecting them and reflected in the following domains: their grouping together with indigenous peoples among the poorest of the poor, their low rate of participation in representation in political and institutional decision-making processes, inequality in access to the labor market, and limited social recognition and validation of their ethnic and cultural diversity, and finally, a disproportionate presence in prison populations. So the committee has recognized that it's critically important to understand the structural nature of racial discrimination, particularly in societies where racial prejudice has been endemic over many eras. It becomes self-perpetuating in the social institutions that determine economic survival and social advancement. Discrimination then takes on a life of its own. It sort of sinks below everybody's level of consciousness. CERD has called for robust special measures and affirmative action programs to be instituted in order to short-circuit and overcome the self-serving definitions of merit that often operate within such institutions to justify the continuation of privileged positions. This key understanding of racial discrimination, of the structural nature, is really central to fashioning remedies. It is essential that states have comprehensive anti-discrimination legislation with strong enforcement agencies. CERD has also recognized how the criminal justice system in multiracial societies can be seen as the instrument of the majority community's power to marginalize minority communities. For example, CERD has acknowledged how racial profiling policies authorize police to engage minority community members with little or no legal justification. Stop and frisk policies, broken windows, policing practices, and aggressive policing of petty offenses can radically increase the number of contacts between minorities and police. Now, as one scholar, Devon Carabato of UCLA Law School, has concluded, in racially charged societies, the frequency of these engagements inscribe Black people as presumptively suspect. They communicate the idea that Black lives do not matter and exposes them to the possibility of police violence.
Speaking for the Caribbean and Latin America, Ramona Hernandez, director of CUNY's Caribbean Studies Institute and a sociology professor at the City University of New York, provided some history of racism in the Caribbean, particularly in her island nation, the Dominican Republic. She reminded the audience of the strong history of resistance as well.
Discrimination against Black people or African descent in Latin America is historical. It goes way back to the first day Black Africans were bought, sold, and brought by force by their owners to a land they knew nothing about. Enslaved African Blacks entered into America Latina as a consisted in their capacity and ability to produce profit to enrich others, those who owned them. Too many African Blacks perished in America Latina, converted into commodity. Those who owned Black people in Latin America had no intention of treating Black who survived differently as equals, to integrate them into society as bona fide members. It was more. The children of Blacks had no better fate. They too had a price which, as their parents, was lower than the price of white children, the future owners of Black Latin American people. It is in La Española, a small island in the Caribbean, where this human devalorization of African Blacks in the Americas began. The system that devalued Blacks as people and valued them only as a commodity that generated the enrichment of others would spread throughout the Americas, and the Spaniard conquistadores, owners of Black people, would be joined by Portuguese conquistadores, English conquistadores, French conquistadores, and Dutch conquistadores. Each of these groups would erect their own version of a social economic system that had in common a perception of Black people and a way of treating them. The common perception about Blacks was ideological, and as such, it permeated all institutions of society where racial inequality existed. Institutional discrimination is a structural discrimination. It is something that does not happen one day. Structured racism is ingrained in society's social fabric, in people's blood, flesh, and souls, and it is perpetrated every day, all the time, systematically, in different ways, from overt to camouflaged manifestations. And as scholar Frank Fanon demonstrated years ago, way too many Blacks born within this system learn to value themselves through a system that devalued them, that considered and treated them as less. In this view of themselves made many Black accomplices of their perpetrators. But oppression breeds resistance. And it is in the same island of La Española where African enslavement began in the Americas, where Blacks began to resist, to fight back. They began to undermine and challenge racism on the same day racial discrimination started against them in that island. This is to say that an ideology based on an alleged inferiority of Blacks did not penetrate all Blacks in America Latina. Did not manage to break all Blacks. There were Blacks who were not alienated from themselves, their history, their culture, and their legacy. Of course not. In fact, I argue that a systematic and long resistance is what explains the survival of the Black African legacy today in the Dominican Republic, a country that shares the island of La Española with the Republic of Haiti. From the 1930s to the 1950s, intellectuals and medical doctors reported to Trujillo that Dominicans were practicing Black religious rites and that they were playing and dancing to the rhythms of African drums. Informants penetrated these groups incognitos. In their reports to Trujillo, the expert concluded that Dominicans were mentally ill, suffering from delusion. They also determined Dominicans were submerged in cultural ignorance. And Trujillo acted against that, all that was African Black in the Dominican Republic. Dominican blackness then remained practiced behind Trujillo's back, changing from overt pride to subversive immodesty. Dissident Dominicans surreptitiously protected their black cultural legacy and secured its arrival as long as Trujillo was in power. And afterwards, when Trujillo's sinister collaborator and successor, Presidente Joaquin Balaguer, took power and furthered the anti-black state policy designed by his predecessor. A way to undermine and dismantle structural racism today is precisely by acknowledging that resistance, by speaking about these subversive actions on the part of black predecessors, by de-victimizing blacks and recognizing their victories, their standing up to evil social structures in societies in America Latina.
Stephen Hawkins, executive director of Amnesty International USA, has a long history of activism as an attorney for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and as executive director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, among others.
Amnesty International took to the streets in Ferguson and in Baltimore because we recognized the human rights crises that were unfolding here in the United States with respect to police use of force against citizens, and particularly black youth. What we recognize is that the police here in the United States are relatively ungoverned in terms of their use of force. Amnesty, as a result of being on the ground in Ferguson and Baltimore, undertook a study, a 50-state study, of the laws on the books in every state within the United States. What we found was shocking. 9 states had no law codified whatsoever with respect to how the police should use lethal force in any given situation. None of the states met the standards prescribed by the international community. And as a result, we've put together some model legislation that comports with international standards, and I'm pleased to announce that Maryland and a few other states are looking at adopting law, Maryland being one of those states that had no law at all on the books and hopefully will adopt the standards that Amnesty has put forth. What we face in terms of policing in the United States is extraordinary in terms of the fact that we have 18,000 local jurisdictions, totally atomized, totally decentralized, so that 4 deputies in some small town can determine whether someone lives or dies on any particular day. That is outrageous. And when I look at the national response to the crisis after 9/11, when we had in this country, in the United States, thousands of local airports, big ones like JFK, but also small regional airports in rural areas and so forth. But within 1 year, the federal government was able to act and create TSA and do something about this totally decentralized approach to airline security. Well, I believe that we face another crisis in this country, and that's the crisis of how black youth are treated by the police in this country. And if the federal government can respond to one crisis, it can respond to this one. And I think the families of Tamir Rice, of Eric Gardner, of Michael Brown, of Andrew Joseph, and so many others call for this government, call for the United States government to react to this crisis in the same way.
Also addressing the meeting was Samiria Rice, whose 12-year-old unarmed son was fatally shot by a Cleveland policeman on November 22, 2014, as the youth was sitting in a local playground, reportedly playing with a toy gun. Someone called police, and within 2 seconds of arriving on the scene, and before their patrol car came to a full stop, one of the 2 officers, Timothy Lohman, fired 2 shots, hitting the preteen once in the torso. Neither officer administered any first aid to Rice after the shooting. He died the following day. In the aftermath of the shooting, it was reported that Lohman, in his previous job as a policeman in Independence, Ohio, had been deemed, quote, an emotionally unstable recruit, unfit for duty. Two independent conclusions about the use of force in this case were submitted to the county prosecutor's office by outside experts, one a retired FBI agent and a second by Colorado prosecutor S. Lamar Sims. Both reported that the shooting of Tamir Rice was, quote, reasonable under the circumstances. Samiria Rice is still fighting for justice for her youngest son and other victims of police violence. In an emotional address, the mother recounted the day her son went out to play, never to return.
And never to return home is a mother and father's nightmare. Tamir was a bright, loving child who was very talented in many ways. Tamir was a member of the Boys and Girls Club. Tamir played many sports. Tamir loved animals and arts and crafts as well. Tamir was the glue to keep our family flowing with love and laughter. Every morning I wake up, I think of Tamir, but also I wake up looking for change across this nation. I wake up seeking justice for my son, and that's why I'm here today. Okay.
You're doing great.
I would like to thank the United Nations for allowing me to speak. I want to thank Bruce Knox and Greg Greer, my team of attorneys, and my family and friends, and a special thanks to my Uncle Mike, who's here with me today. May God bless this nation and this world. Thank you.
D.C.-based attorney Nicole Lee is a senior advisor to Mothers Against Police Brutality. She detailed steps needed to stop police violence against citizens of color, including, she said, a national database of problem officers.
Mothers Against Police Brutality was founded by Colette Flanagan after a Dallas police officer shot her son, Clinton Allen, to death on March 10, 2013. Clinton, a 25-year-old African-American father of two, was unarmed when he was shot 7 times. There were no charges brought in this official homicide, no indictment, no prosecution, no trial, no loss of pay for the officer, no punishment of any kind. It was out of this experience of unaccountable police violence that Mothers Against Police Brutality was formed. We seek specific steps to make our police departments more accountable to the public. Specific steps that focus on the pressure points surrounding police killings and brutality that include special prosecutors to replace the ineffective and compromised district attorney investigations, timely drug testing of officers, psychological evaluation and cultural competence of officers, and compensation for victims' families, use of body cameras, and standardized deadly force training approved by the Federal Justice Department. Also, reevaluation of the criteria for civil rights violations in police shootings and a national database of problem officers. But Mothers Against Police Brutality know that reforming the system is simply not enough. Mothers and family members know all too well that reforming police forces does not eradicate state violence. It is just one of the many manifestations of structural racism that keeps people of African descent from achieving our full potential.
And concluding the panel discussion, Alicia Garza, co-founder of the call to action group Black Lives Matter. Garza describes Black Lives Matter as, quote, an ideological and political intervention in a world where black lives are systematically and intentionally targeted for demise. It is an affirmation, says Garza, of black folks' contribution to this society, our humanity, and our resilience in the face of deadly oppression.
I start by saying that anti-black racism saturates every aspect of our society in the United States. In a country where black bodies were amongst the first currency in our economy, and where black people are counted as 3/5 of a human being for the purposes of apportioning power to those who owned other people and away from those who were owned, it's hard to find any system, any structure, any policy, or practice that's advanced by the United States that is not steeped in our violent origins. In 2014, black people were 13.2% of our total population. Yet this year alone, 960 people were killed by the police, with black people being twice as likely to be killed than whites or Latinos. According to the Malcolm X grassroots movement, every 28 hours in this country, a black person is murdered by police, security guards, or vigilantes. While black men are more likely to be killed by the police, black women are more likely to experience sexual violence at the hands of those who are sworn to protect and serve us. Over the last 10 years, women in prisons has increased by 138%. 90% of those women are single mothers and often lose contact with their children forever. In fact, we are the fastest growing prison population in the United States. The majority of women who are locked up commit what we call, quote unquote, crimes of survival or economic crimes. In fact, 80% of these women earn less than $2,000 a year at the time of their arrest. Black women are three times more likely than white women to be single heads of households with children under the age of 18. More than 21 transgendered women, most of whom were black, have been reported murdered since the beginning of 2015, though so many are not reported, and when they are reported, they are misgendered. The average life expectancy of a black transgender woman is 35 years old, and that is due to both murder and poverty. Our mothers are being robbed of the ability to see our children grow up, become adults, and perhaps even have families of our own. We are half the prison population in a country that incarcerates more people than anywhere else in the world. Black women make 64 cents to every 78 cents that white women make to every dollar that a white man makes. Generations of structural racism have burdened black communities with overwhelming debt. And today, while the typical white household is worth $141,900, the typical black household in the United States is worth $11,000. 1 in 13 black people born in the United States is unable to vote because of felony convictions, and lawmakers in our country continue to pass restrictive covenants that deny black people access to a robust democracy. There are 500,000 undocumented black immigrants within the borders of the United States who are both being criminalized for being undocumented and criminalized for being black. For black people, especially those of us who exist at the intersections of gender, class, citizenship status, and sexuality, it is a daily struggle to simply live while black, much less thrive while black. The United States has failed to adequately and robustly engage in truthful and honest reconciliation as it relates to the persistence, prevalence, and dire consequences of anti-black racism. Any best practices or recommendations must be grounded in the willingness of the United States to admit that there is still a war on people of African descent. We question the ability of this nation state to remain united when people of African descent are excluded, marginalized, disenfranchised, and murdered with impunity. And this misery is all sanctioned by the state. We agree with our allies at the Malcolm X grassroots movement that we need a comprehensive national plan of action for racial justice that looks at how to address the stark disparities facing people of African descent in America. We can drastically reduce the population of people of color, and specifically black people, in prisons and jails by addressing disparities in our criminal system and in our economic system, paying particular attention to sentencing and diversion, investing in community programs that are culturally relevant, and interrupting bias with judges, prosecutors, district attorneys, and of course the police. We must end the drug war as a part of ending the war on black communities. An end to the criminalization of poverty and the militarization of civil society will go a long way in protecting the sanctity of black life. A social wage is required to ensure that all families have access to dignity in this country. A more robust democracy with no barriers to access to it can only be achieved by the enfranchisement of black people, which means enfranchising former felons and currently incarcerated people and prohibiting any restrictions to access to democracy. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, We must ensure that adequate resources are reinvested in Black communities that have been devastated by deinvestment. Reparations for the slave trade, but also reparations for the wealth that has been deliberately stolen from people of African descent. Let this decade be the one where Black people throughout the diaspora are seen as the solutions, the future to the sanctity of this world, rather than problems to be fixed. Thank you.
Alicia Garza of Black Lives Matter. And reporting for Where We Live, I'm Sally O'Brien.
And we thank Sally O'Brien for that special presentation at the United Nations on November 3rd, Confronting the Silence, Perspectives and Dialogue on Structural Racism Against People of African Descent Worldwide.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation. Say you're sorry. There is no other choice. God bless the people now who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring
Michael Frante, bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. This is The Morning Show on radio station WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Please do visit us online at WBAI.org. You'll find out a lot of information about the radio station in general and also how to contribute to this commercial-free, listener-supported community radio station. A lot more radio ahead coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. Starting things off, Bob Henley with a look ahead at the week to unfold. But right now, I want to continue on with the serialized presentation of the book Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. It's an authentic historical narrative describing the horrors of slavery as experienced by Black women. On The Morning Show on WBAI.
When the sun go down,
I'll be so mad. When the sun go down, I don't let's leave it, but I wanna lie down.
Dr. Flint, a physician in the neighborhood, had married the sister of my mistress, and I was now the property of their little daughter. It was not without murmuring that I prepared for my new home, and what added to my unhappiness was the fact that my brother William was purchased by the same family. My father, by his nature, as well as by the habit of transacting business as a skillful mechanic, had more of the feelings of a free man than is common among slaves. My brother was a spirited boy, and being brought up under such influences, he early detested the name of master and mistress. One day, when his father and his mistress both happened to call him at the same time, he hesitated between the two, being perplexed to know which had the strongest claim upon his obedience. He finally concluded to go to his mistress. When my father reproved him for it, he said, "You both called me, and I didn't know which one I ought to go to first." "You are my child," replied our father, "and when I call you, you should come immediately, if you have to pass through fire and water." Poor Willie! He was now to learn his first lesson of obedience to a master. Grandmother tried to cheer us with hopeful words, and they found an echo in the credulous hearts of youth. When we entered our new home, we encountered cold looks, cold words, and cold treatment. We were glad when the night came. On my narrow bed, I moaned and wept. I felt so desolate and alone. I had been there nearly a year when a dear little friend of mine was buried. I heard her mother sob as the clods fell on the coffin of her only child, and I turned away from the grave, feeling thankful that I still had something left to love. I met my grandmother, who said, "Come with me, Linda." And from her tone, I knew something sad had happened. She led me apart from the people and then said, "My child, your father is dead." Dead? How could I believe it? He had died so suddenly I had not even heard that he was sick. I went home with my grandmother. My heart rebelled against God, who had taken from me mother, father, mistress, and friend. The good grandmother tried to comfort me. "Who knows the ways of God?" she said. "Perhaps they have kindly taken from the evil days to come." Years afterward, I often thought of this. She promised to be a mother to her grandchildren, so far as she might be permitted to do so, and strengthened by her love. I returned to my master's. I thought I should be allowed to go to my father's house the next morning, but I was ordered to go for flowers, that my mistress's house might be decorated for an evening party. I spent the day gathering flowers and weaving them into festoons. While the dead body of my father was lying within a mile of me, what cared my owners for that? He was merely a piece of property. Moreover, they thought he had spoiled his children by teaching them to feel that they were human beings. This was blasphemous doctrine for a slave to teach, presumptuous in him, and dangerous to the masters. The next day I followed his remains to a humble grave besides that of my dear mother. There were those who knew my father's worth and respected his memory. My home now seemed more dreary than ever. The laugh of little slave children sounded harsh and cruel. It was selfish to feel so about the joy of others. My brother moved about with a very grave face. I tried to comfort him by saying, "Take courage, Willie. Brighter days will come by and by." "You don't know anything about it, Linda," he replied. "We shall have to stay here all of our days. We shall never be free." I argued that we were growing older and stronger, and that perhaps we might, before long, be allowed to hire our own time, and then we could earn money to buy our freedom. William declared this was much easier to say than to do. Moreover, he did not intend to buy his freedom. We held daily controversies upon this subject. Little attention was paid to the slaves' meal in Dr. Flint's house. If they could catch a bit of food while it was going, well and good. I gave myself no trouble on that score, for on my various errands, I passed my grandmother's house, where there was always something to spare for me. I was frequently threatened with punishment if I stopped there. and my grandmother, to avoid detaining me, often stood at the gate with something for my breakfast or dinner. I was indebted to her for all my comforts, spiritual or temporal. It was her labor that supplied my scanty wardrobe. I have a vivid recollection of the linsey woolsey dress given me every winter by Miss Flint. How I hated it. It was one of the badges of slavery. While my grandmother was thus helping to support me from her hard earnings, the $300 she had lent her mistress were never repaid. When her mistress died, her son-in-law, Dr. Flint, was appointed executor. When grandmother applied to him for payment, he said the estate was insolvent and the law prohibited payment. It did not, however, prohibit him from retaining the silver candelabra which had been purchased with that money. I presume they will be handed down in the family from generation to generation. My grandmother's mistress had always promised that at her death she should be free, and it was said that in her will she made good the promise. But when the estate was settled, Dr. Flint told the faithful old servant that under existing circumstances it was necessary she should be sold.
Well, you won't be worried when the sun go down.
When the sun go down,
you'll never be worried when the sun go down.
When the sun go down.
Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Linda Brent. That was read by Tina Dixon from WHCR up in City College in New York last year when we were up there. That is, WBAI was in the studios of WHCR. So thanks to Tina Dixon. Several of the women from WBAI have participated thus far in the serialized reading of Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, the authentic historical narrative describing the horrors of slavery as experienced by black women, and bring that to you in serialized form, and going to play it from time to time throughout the morning show. It's 7:02 here in New York City at 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. Better hang loose. That's right. Hang loose at 7:03 on a Monday morning here in New York City. I'm Michael G. Haskins. Good morning, everyone, and thanks so much for tuning in. And what's the temperature outside? 54 degrees right now, going up to a high of 64. So I have one sweater on too many, but that's all right. I can put it in my bag. It's better to have it than not have it. At least that's what my mother said, and I subscribe to that. How's everybody doing this morning? Well, Jed Brandt is not with me as he usually is on Monday morning. Jed will be away for, I think, about 6 weeks, but this Monday morning, Jeannie Hopper is joining me in studio, and I want to say good morning to you, Jeannie. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. Good morning to all of our listeners as well.
And I just want to say that during this 7 o'clock hour, we'll be speaking with Bob Henley in just a few minutes. Bob Henley joins us from time to time on Monday morning at this time. And we'll be talking about, of course, the horrific events last week as the week came to a close in Paris, France. And then some local issues, some national issues and some regional issues as well with Bob Henley. And then a little bit later on in this hour, who are we going to be speaking with, Jeannie?
We'll be speaking with Kevin Powell. He has a new book, his 12th book, to come out. This one is a very intimate insight autobiography into his life as a child and coming up here in Newark, New Jersey, and college, and interesting parallels with issues that we're still facing as he came of age in realizing the struggle and awareness of civil rights here in the United States.
So we'll be looking forward to speaking with Kevin just about at 7:30, 7:35 this morning. But first things first, as always, at 7:05, we have news with Linda Perry.
Good morning. Here's some of the news for Monday morning, November 16, 2015. On Friday evening, gunmen and bombers attacked restaurants, a concert hall, and a sports stadium at locations across Paris. This left 129 dead, 99 in critical condition, and more than 300 wounded. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the attacks.
C'est un acte de guerre qui a été commis par une armée terroriste, Daesh, une armée djihadiste contre la France. Contre les valeurs que nous défendons partout dans le monde.
French President François Hollande promised swift retaliation for what he called an act of war, acts of terrorism and barbarism.
C'est un acte de guerre qui a été préparé, organisé, planifié de l'extérieur et avec des complicités intérieures que l'enquête permettra d'établir. C'est un acte d'une barbarie absolue.
On Sunday, President Obama reiterated what he had said right after the attacks, that the U.S. stands with France.
The killing of innocent people based on a twisted ideology is an attack not just on France, not just on Turkey, but it's an attack on the civilized world.
On Sunday evening, France launched airstrikes on Raqqa. That's what the Islamic State group has been using as its capital in Syria. It's located on the north bank of the Euphrates River. The French Ministry of Defense said they destroyed a jihadi training camp and a munitions dump. Iraqi intelligence say that's where Friday's attack on Paris was planned. The jets were launched from sites in Jordan and the Persian Gulf in coordination with U.S. forces. An ISIS-affiliated website confirmed the strikes on the center of the city, saying 10 people had been killed and dozens wounded. It also published photographs purportedly showing victims, including two of young boys, suggesting that they were civilians. Across the U.S., vigils were held in solidarity with the people of France. In Washington Square Park, people gathered over the weekend to talk about the attacks.
Well, my thoughts are very sad, and I feel very, very afraid of the world that we are living in.
Marie-Jules Ingle is a retired French teacher.
I was very shocked that you two, for example, canceled the concert. I think we all have to keep living the way we have, and not let anybody intimidate us. And I think this rally here is wonderful, just because there is so much respect, and obviously, you know, people are not loud, people are in pain, and it's just a wonderful sense of community.
Some point out that when there are attacks like this in non-Western countries, they don't get the same amount of attention. For instance, in April, at least 147 people, mostly students, were killed in an assault by al-Shabaab militants on a university in northeastern Kenya. Witnesses said the militants singled out Christians and shot them. Al-Shabaab says it attacked the university because it is at war with Kenya. Meanwhile, in the aftermath of the Paris attacks, people all over the world and belonging to all faiths have reiterated that the blame for growing international conflict cannot be put on Muslims or people belonging to the Islamic faith. And on Sunday, President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed Syria's civil war. This was on the sidelines of the G20 Economic Summit in Turkey. The U.S. administration says Obama and Putin agreed that Syria needs a political transition led by Syrians, preceded by negotiations mediated by the U.N. and a ceasefire. Obama and Putin have long been at odds about whether there's a role for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad after the transition. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Ne me quitte pas, il faut oublier tout, peut s'oublier qui s'enfuit déjà, oublier le temps. Des malentendus et le temps perdu à savoir comment oublier ces heures qui tuaient parfois à coups de pourquoi le cœur du bonheur ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Ah, moi, je t'offrirai des perles de pluie venues de pays où il ne pleut pas. Je creuserai la terre jusqu'après ma mort pour couvrir ton corps d'or et de lumière. Je ferai un domaine où l'amour sera roi, où l'amour sera loi, où tu seras reine. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Ne me quitte pas, je t'inventerai des mots insensés que tu comprendras, je te parlerai de ces amants-là qui ont vu deux fois leur cœur s'embraser. Je te raconterai l'histoire de ce roi mort de n'avoir pas pu te rencontrer. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. On a vu souvent rejaillir le feu de l'ancien volcan qu'on croyait trop vieux. Il est, paraît-il, des terres brûlées donnant plus de blé qu'un meilleur avril. Et qu'on vient le soir pour qu'un ciel flamboie rouge ou noir ne s'épouse-t-il pas. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas. Ne me quitte pas, je ne vais plus pleurer, je ne vais plus parler, je me cacherai là. À te regarder danser, sourire, à t'écouter chanter et puis rire. Laisse-moi devenir l'ombre de ton ombre, l'ombre de ta main, l'ombre de ton chien. Mais ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas.
Ne me quitte pas, Jacques Brel, who made this song quite famous. We played the Nina Simone version at the top of the 6 o'clock hour, but this is really what people know very much. Don't leave me, don't leave me. For the people of Paris, France, this Monday morning here in New York City at WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Michael G. Haskins here in studio. Jed Brandt not with me. He won't be with me for a couple of weeks, a few weeks. Jeannie Hopper is in studio with me this morning, and we welcome Bob Henley in just a moment to us. And thanks to you, all of you, for tuning in this Monday morning and staying with us. However you listen to us, whether it's terrestrially, on the radio, if you're in a car, in a vehicle, or if you're on your smartphone or device or listening on a podcast, thanks for being with us.
And thank you so much for your support during our fall membership drive. We can't thank you enough. That is what fuels this station. Literally, listener-sponsored radio.
Yeah, without a doubt, without a doubt. The brutal events in Paris last week dominated the news over the weekend and were the topic, the first topic on Saturday night's Democratic presidential debate, which was originally going to focus exclusively on the economy. President Obama is in Turkey for a two-day summit involving the G20 countries where discussing how best to respond to the events in Paris will no doubt be on top of the agenda. With us now, as he is every Monday, unless we're in pledge drive, is Bob Henley. Bob, good morning, and welcome back, and thanks for being with us this morning.
Good morning, and it's such a thrill to hear Jeannie's voice, not on Saturday night when I'm in party mode.
Hey, Bob, how are
you? Bringing some party to Monday.
Some party to Monday.
Wake up.
So, Bob, first, what is the G20? Yeah, let's start with that. And what role can they play in the current global crisis?
Well, I guess it's the 20 major economies of the world, an international forum. It's also got central bank governors on it, the 19 countries, just looking at the laundry list, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, Italy, Japan, South Korea, Mexico, Russia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and the United States, and the European Union. This was founded back in 1999 as a way of getting creating a focal point for the world's wealthiest nations. It represents roughly about 85% of the world's gross domestic product, about 80% of the world trade. It kind of supplanted the G8, it's fairly controversial. They have, what can they do? Well, certainly if China, Russia, and the United States actually developed a consensus about what to do, that, might make a difference. The problem is you'll notice that none of the countries that are the seat of such violence are involved in this, really. So you have this kind of a legacy of the colonial era where you have these wealthy nations kind of still the centralized bureaucracy kind of dictating to the rest of the world based on our worldview. And I'd submit that that's part of what's driving this problem. There just is, why does a narrative like ISIS have meaning to people? Well, what is the competing story we're offering them? Global capitalism? Mm. Is that working out great? So, if you're a young man and you're coming of age in these places that we just bomb regularly, and that's what we do, and we've been doing that, and before that we extracted oil out of them and then put dictators in charge of them, and then when people got upset, well, we helped the dictators. So this is, and I am so in some ways feeling it's such a, I have had the pleasure of being in Paris, and that is tremendously tragic what happened. Mm-hmm. But that violence that we saw, that everyone just stopped their breath and stopped all programming, has been going on in the Middle East for decades, every day.
Yes.
So I feel a kind of tension. I don't want to, of course it's a great tragedy, and it shouldn't happen in Paris, but it shouldn't be happening in Baghdad either, and it shouldn't be happening in Yemen. And for some reason, we've just decided that that's a shooting gallery, and this is culture in terms of Paris.
Sorry, is that weird? No, not at all.
You know what? Actually, I don't know if you did hear the show Saturday night, but one of the things that I had mentioned was that, in fact, and again, it's not to play off and have, one
lesser or greater than the other, but this past week there was the bombing in Beirut.
Right.
As well. Right. And on top of that, you know, the continuation of the latest in the West Bank and Hebron.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well
and,
said.
Yeah. And, you know, and listening to the social media noise, so to speak, as well, it was interesting to see that commentary actually come up. We seem to become kind of this robotic, join the social media trend with putting, you know, the image of the French flag over your photo. And I found that dialogue really interesting with people actually, you know, calling other people out and saying, you know, 500 homeless who died last year in France, did you upload a flag like this then? Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
so there absolutely is this dichotomy.
And that to be coupled with, as you said, Bob, you mentioned young people and young men in particularly, but not certainly not exclusively in their 20s and, you know, no direction specifically. And you couple that with the bombing going on in these parts of the world that they're from, some of them, and they have mothers, fathers, cousins, aunts that they love and they revere just as and the people in Paris, just as we do. And, you know, when these things happen, there are consequences. And I don't know whether the folks that actually, you know, conduct these operations fully grasp that, or possibly they do, but you know it's collateral damage,
well,
and they don't
we
care.
We've talked about this that there, and the issue of global youth unemployment has been festering for years now, and there's a total connection between coming of age and agency. What do I mean by agency? I mean the sense that you have dominion over yourself. You can make choices for yourself that matter. You can provide support for your family and your loved ones in your community, that you have a place. Global capitalism it destroys this, and this is we're up against it now. We are up against it right now. It erodes these things that come from individual agency. And so every kind of conversation that doesn't go back to this core thing, we have to remember, before it gets twisted around by the right-wing mainstream media, what happened in Tunisia, that it was a millennial in his 20s who had a fruit stand that was supporting his family, that the police came, like Groundhog Day, confiscated his wares. And on this particular day, he was not going to go quietly, and so he set himself on fire. That was not about jihad. That was about interdependence and family and obligation and love. And so our inability, and that won't, we won't go back to that. And so that's why it's so imperative to continue this line of examination. And in my CBS incarnation, I covered the debates and between former Governor O'Malley, former Secretary of State Clinton, Senator Sanders, and this was, of course, the first 30-minute topic. I was struck by the fact that this did not come up. I mean, as much as Senator Sanders certainly had the more deliberate and, I'd say, progressive point of view, Hillary Clinton said a whole bunch of nothing. I mean, it was just, I mean, I parsed it, typed it up, looked at the transcript, and tried to divine something out of it, and it was stunning. She was breathing and lived through that period. But was there actually a nonverb correct object I could say was something? No.
Mm-hmm. No.
O'Malley was forceful and impressive, but nobody mentioned this core issue, because the what has happened, and this is part of the whole network, whatever network it is, there is a certain kind of thing they pull out of the trunk that they have at moments like this that is a drumbeat to war. And that's how we got into Iraq. That's how we, you know, the Barney Fife analogy, don't want to, you know, besmirch Don Knotts. I love him as an actor, but the character Barney Fife has been the United States government since 9/11. And a vengeful Barney Fife with a tremendous firepower. And we have to step back and look at the exponential number of dead human beings since 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I can't say it enough. I don't think people hear it enough. And I especially think it's important for us to say it now that we're poised to do something even bigger.
Yes, we are. It's 7:25, just about 7:25 on a Monday morning. And I'm Michael G. Haskins in studio this morning with Jeannie Hopper. We're on the line with Bob Henley, who regularly reports for CBS News Money Watch, for City and State, for Salon, and other publications. Bob, the original focus of Saturday's debate was the economy, and there were some pretty significant differences between the candidates on the issues, weren't there?
Right, yeah, I just about fell off my chair when Hillary Clinton thought that $12 an hour for minimum wage would
right.
be good enough.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a lot of my daughters and my family so badly want a woman president. I got to, you know, Jeannie, your gender is due. You absolutely, you're due. We have been screwing it up forever. Enough white men for, you know, a while. But the question is, when she says $12 an hour, I just couldn't believe it. And O'Malley came in for $15 for a living wage, and so did Sanders. When Sanders did take it to Clinton in the sense of the millions of dollars from Wall Street that she's received and her husband received, I mean, they're actually, like, supported enterprises of Wall Street, her response was, well, I did a very good job reconstructing Lower Manhattan. And, you know, and intimating that that's why, because she helped repair the financial district after 9/11, that's why they were getting all the support, of course, the support of Wall Street and investment banks to the Clintons, you know, almost began at the beginning of their career, they had support from those kinds of interests. So there is a clear distinction now that's emerged on these economic issues. And also, as we've discussed before, we know that President Clinton and the Congress, the Gingrich Congress, repealed Glass-Steagall, which was a Depression-era protection that separated regular banking from speculative investment kinds of schemes.
Served us well.
And, right. And so they took that down just to get that dynamic economy going. And, of course, it melted down, and we were dealing with the consequences, like 14,000 empty homes in Baltimore. Sanders and O'Malley both want to see that put back up. Clinton does not. So, and yet there is still, I've got to say, this kind of McKinney's Deus within the Democratic Party to coronate, you know, Secretary of State Clinton.
Well, Bob, let's shift gears a bit, if I may. I know last week you covered for CBS News the massive hacking case that prosecutors say compromised the personal data of 100 million people. Did you hear me? 100 million people now. Give us the Reader's Digest version of that, if you would.
This is a mind blower. I mean, this is something that makes you nostalgic for, you know, snail mail. Apparently, it's a group of young men. Oh, there's a theme here. I didn't even notice this.
Yes, indeed.
20-somethings, 30-somethings, all out of kind of Florida State in a fraternity down there, really bright guys, two of them from Israel, one of them from the United States, now living in Russia. I guess that's a thing now, like a Snowden thing you do. And they cooked up this ability to tap into J.P. Morgan's database. Let's see, Dow Jones, Scottrade, E-Trade, and harvest personal data. And then, knowing that people are, you know, so often we're universally greedy, would create spam stock tips. Now, that there you go, buying stock off of spam. Now, does that seem like who would do that? Well, evidently, people did, and these guys would pump up the price of these phony stocks and then sell them short and make hundreds of millions of dollars. That was just one division of this ongoing cyber global crime spree. Then they had 12 casinos operating illegally from nowhere in particular, and there was another division which was involved with installing malware and operating systems and then charging you ransom to get your computer back. This went on for a few years, and evidently it got to the point where they had $100 million in a Swiss bank account and were really running the table And then sometime last year in the summer, J.P. Morgan got a sense that something was wrong, proactive they, and then gave the government heads up. And they basically popped these guys, I guess. Some of them went down in July. Some of them were arrested over the summer. And then it was announced this week. The one thing that I was underreported that I discovered in the indictment was that this crew was able to take over a credit union in New Jersey. That's right.
Wow.
Not just rob a bank, capture the entire bank. Something called Help Other People Excel, a little credit union opened in 1978 for low-income people, a self-help kind of thing. Had around 96 members, about $280,000 in total assets. And these bozos from Florida State churned through millions and millions of dollars where they would convert that fabulous Bitcoin, which makes a lot of people scratch their head, this kind of abstract currency that doesn't involve any centralized authority. Oh, how cool is that? This would be a clearinghouse. So if your operating system was kidnapped by crypto war or some other malevolent computer virus, you could pay into this bank in Bitcoin and get your computer back, and then they would convert the Bitcoin into currency for the other cyber criminals. So, yes, and of course the government did not really mention the aspect of the entire bank being taken over. That was kind of just buried in the sauce.
And I also see reported the guys behind the global cybercrime. This was the spree over New Jersey Bank that you just talked about. I don't know. What's going on here, Bob? We've gotten more things going on this week as we look at the week ahead. Is there anything else that you want to outline before we
say goodbye for
the morning?
You know, I do want to say that one of the things that came out of my investigation in this was that I wasn't aware of this, but in terms of your personal data, which if you're doing business, you're compelled to offer up to the government, to motor vehicle, to whoever. You need to know that what you're told about a hack of your data and the theft of said data is entirely based on the state you live in. There is no uniform federal standard for identity theft. That's right. We have a global internet commerce place that absolutely has no federal standard for identity theft. So I think you need to be more careful about it. Like, for instance, in Maryland, if your name is stolen, you've got to be notified. But if your passport number or your motor vehicle, your license is that number stolen, you don't have to be told, even your Social Security number. So it's really critical to take the next extra step and think through. As far as what's coming up this week, I have a huge piece coming out in City and State that looks at the crisis in transportation that we have in our region, the billions of dollars that we're paying, much of it in borrowed money, to get from point A to point B. And I posit the idea of, as it is now, we have all these bureaucracies. You have the New Jersey Transit, Metropolitan Transit Authority, the Port Authority, you name it. And the reality is that these things were created, in the case of the Port Authority 100 years ago. And, we're seeing the price of getting from A to B just going up and up and up, and our wages are declining. So I talked to some experts about the idea of integrating all of these bureaucracies into one metropolitan transit district. As it is now, just go to Penn Station. You've got four or five police departments bumping into each other for the same waiting room. I mean, really.
That's right. Right.
And so this raises that question. And then I'm also looking at the tremendous rise in white male suicide, which is, we got a brand problem, Michael. It's kind of like people don't like white guys anyway. So it's not like there's going to be a movement like we overplayed our hand for years. And so with global capitalism not working out, white skin privilege isn't what it was, so we're killing ourselves. So we'll talk about that.
Well, yeah, which some of you certainly want to keep an eye on as well. Bob, thank you so much for being
Jamie,
with us this
so much.
Morning.
Sure. And the
all
root
right.
of all this, once again, is that global capitalism eroding all.
It is. And
all hope,
there is,
as well yes. as.
Well, I have to say, Kate, this is a plug. I do see you know, my daughter's CSA and her peer group, you know, she started this organic cooperative, had 15 families last season, has 50 now. There is room to hope.
Well,
there are young people making a difference. This station is part of that alternative model.
Yeah. You know, Bob, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that always comes to mind for me when I see people struggling. They find a way. How do they find the way? By other people around them lifting them up and helping each other. And eventually, I have this very idealistic idea that, you know, maybe we won't need so much those governments, and they won't be in our business, because they'll render us so forced to be extremely independent and finding a means of surviving that, guess what, maybe we will create one bit at a time a better world, just like your daughter.
I vote for you for class president.
Thank you. Coming up is Kevin Powell, and about his book as a kid, so I'm very inspired from his words, having read his autobiography and being engrossed in it.
All right, you have a great week, guys.
All right, thanks so much, Bob. Bye. Bob Henley, who joins us most Mondays at this time. Bob Henley, who writes for CBS News Money Watch, and you can find that online, Salon, City and State, and other publications. This is The Morning Show on WBAI 735. There's more straight ahead. Don't forget, coming up at 8 o'clock will be Democracy Now!, so keep your dials right where they are. If you're listening on a radio dial, I got to check that, Jeannie. I have to remind myself not to do that, because everybody is not on a radio dial. So, all right, I apologize. Connect with us any way that you can. But it is 99.5 FM, if it's a radio dial.
Or multiple devices.
That's right.
I have my phone on.
Yep,
when I go walk the dog,
absolutely.
I got my headphones and the phone streaming. Then I come back into the apartment. I've got the good old analog terrestrial radio going in the kitchen.
Yep,
and then, you know, there's many ways to check in. And I always tell people that, even more so, radio is more powerful than ever. It's just that we're able to access it in different ways.
Absolutely.
We have choices.
A combination of narrowcasting and broadcasting,
That's the best
of both worlds.
And I want to give folks one little hint, though. If you do go into our audio archives on the website from the homepage, it's right above where you can sign up for our Twitter account as well, which we recommend in following our news updates and more. If you right click or control and then click, if you're on a Mac with no mouse, onto the actual image of the audio player, there is a way to download. So you can take that audio with you on the go, aka somewhat of a podcast, not coming at you as a subscription, but you do have that option. So when you're out there traversing in our underground terrestrial ways as well, you can not miss a beat.
All right. Well, useful information for you this morning, but you have to go to WBAI.org.
Yeah.
We are the clearinghouse for all of this information. Thank you so much again for tuning in. Just before we move over to Kevin Powell, if I can get this ready, I just wanted to share a bit of information. And I'll try to do that. Unfortunately,
I know
don't
we
have it right now.
Apropos song for.
We'll get that. We have that. We'll bring that up. But the other piece of information I wanted to share about the passing, someone who just recently passed, I'll share that with you on
A-T
the other side.
AT would the initials be?
No.
Oh, that was last week.
Last week, no. But we'll get that in just a moment.
It's the season for the Pacifica Radio Archive's annual National Broadcast Fund Drive. This year, our two-day broadcast beginning on Tuesday, November 17th at 6 a.m. kicks off 10 days of history for the holidays, ending on November 27th, or Black Friday. Consider this alternative to the frenzy and give the gift of knowledge, of history that lasts a lifetime and can be shared with family and friends. We will be presenting historic and inspiring recordings from the collection going back to 1949, including John Lennon, recently restored women's history programs, 4 hours of a rare Jimi Hendrix documentary, and newly discovered recordings. So tune into your Pacifica station Tuesday, November 17th and 18th for the Pacifica Radio Archives annual Fund Drive broadcast. You can listen and donate online at pacificaradioarchives.org.
PacificaRadioArchives.org. WBAI is part, at this moment, part of the Pacifica network of commercial-free, listener-sponsored community radios. And, Jeannie, I just wanted to mention the person that had just passed, Brother Sekou Malik Osei. He was known as Brother Osei. He was an active journalist and adjunct professor at Medgar Evers College, NYU, Fordham University, and Columbia. And he was mentored by the late program director of WBAI, Samori Marksman, and of course a member of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, and under Alambé Brath, of course. And he was a member of the Guerrilla Journalism. When we have Milton Alamadi on most Tuesdays, we talk about guerrilla journalism. So we're sorry for his passing, and condolences to the family.
And we welcome now to the airwaves Kevin Powell. Welcome to WBAI.
Good morning. It's so good to be back. It's been a long time, and I appreciate all of you.
Yeah, and but your name does not go without mentioning around the halls here of WBAI and on air.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And forgive me, I'm still, like I said, I would be in the studio. I'm just recovering from a week in California with the serious flu symptoms, so I apologize for not being there in person.
Yeah, bi-coastal traveling, I'm sure, did not help.
Yes, ma'am.
But just so folks know, if you're not familiar, Kevin Powell is the author and or editor of 11 previous books, his 12th one now. Just released, Kevin? Is it out
now? That's right. It's just out, yes. Absolutely.
The Education of Kevin Powell, an autobiography of his childhood and young adult life, out on, is it Atria Records, Books?
Yeah, right, Atria Books, which is a division of Simon & Schuster, yeah.
All right, and for folks that may not know Kevin Powell, I don't understand how they couldn't know your name through the years, but let's school them a little bit. You created an organization which is still running and operating called Building Knowledge, or BK Nation, a national progressive multicultural organization focused on issues as like education, civic engagement, leadership training, health and wellness, social media, arts and culture, and job and small business creation. And most may remember you as one of the premier editors of Vibe magazine in the 90s.
Well, I hope that your audience is very savvy, and you know, I'm an activist. More importantly, most important to me, you know, as I was listening to a gentleman run down the names of Samori Marksman,
Michael G.
Lumbee Brath, Mr. Michael G. Exactly. You know, this is the world I grew up in. You know, so when I see things happening, like what just happened in France, you know, what I always say to people is, we've been talking about over the weekend, myself as a fellow activist in L.A., you know, we should be upset about any form of violence that happens, and we can't just have selective outrage. You know, there was folks that were killed in Beirut last week as well, but you barely hear anything about that in any kind of mainstream media. And we know, of course, in this country, there's violence happening every single day, be it domestic violence against women, be it the violence that's happening in our communities, be it the mass shootings. You know, so my work is most importantly, for me, it's over the last 30 years as an activist in dealing with issues of race, gender, class, as you said, education. We do an annual clothing drive for homeless young people that's coming up in a couple of weeks, which I'd love to come back and talk with you all about. And just really about justice and equality for all people. I'm certainly a writer, certainly an activist. This is, as you said, my 12th book, and I've been doing this since I was very young as well. And, you know, for me, I wouldn't write this book if I wasn't willing to be transparent and honest about my own life, and hopefully it could be a tool for other people. And it's been really incredible going around the country. We've been in a lot of places. I'm getting right back on a train tomorrow to Baltimore, Philadelphia this week. And what I've purposely been doing every stop is using the book as a way to have community conversation and to help people think about some issues and how we can move toward action steps. Because as you all know, we can talk, but what are we actually going to do in our local communities in New York and around the country?
Well, just to mention some of the chapters in the book, the first part, it's actually in two parts, Trapped in a Concrete Box. And the intimacy of telling this these intimate stories about your mother and growing up, being brought from the South to New Jersey, and the trials and tribulations of for your mom and your auntie are stories that we hear often, but not in such intimacy as you've shared. And what was especially profound for me in reading it is, it's first of all, it's a great read, Kevin.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So it, don't think it's a balance of really very engaging, as well as really giving kind of this innocent telling of your situation and the awareness as you were coming of age, and the influence of, you know, your mother and the frustrations. And something that really struck me is that even in talking about moving forward when you reach the point of going into college, these same issues continue to resonate from the situation you had with your first encounter with a police officer being arrested, to your encounter in college and finding this awareness and your energies and where to place them, rather than from the frustrations of coming up with the limitations and the dichotomy of the world that was surrounding you between black and white and Latino.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm a voracious reader, and so, you know, there's a lot of things that influenced the writing of this memoir, which, you know, as you said, it's purposely divided into two parts. I really wanted to focus on, you know, age 3 to 18 in the first half, and then the rest of it actually comes all the way up to my 40s where I'm at now. But as a kid, you know, I loved, you know, fiction. I loved Charles Dickens. I loved those kind of coming-of-age stories like S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders, things like that. And you're right, when I got to college is when I became politicized and I started reading.
And you also mentioned Hemingway was a super pivotal.
Oh, Hemingway's, he's the first one that I read. And his writing blew my mind. Just, The Old Man and the Sea still gives me chills all these years later just to read something like that. You know, the kind of writing that he just captured, you know, these human stories, you know.
Before jumping too far forward, that experience of your mother taking you to a library, it's seemingly something so simple, but right now we're in a struggle to save libraries here in the United States and redefined what a library is. And it became this whole world that opened up to you, especially in your discussing Hemingway. And I do have to say that this is a book, I've only gotten halfway through it. So I have to say it's a book that I think any mother should have their child read, especially a young boy and young girls. But you go into such intimacy and those struggles that we have as kids that oftentimes those thoughts are in our head and our parents and adults have no idea, you know, the struggle.
Well, you know, I'm glad you raised that because the book is, you know, is dedicated to my mother. I say she's the first leader and teacher I ever met. You know, a lot of times when I meet younger people now who are activists or social change agents, they say, you know, well, who do you look up to? I'm just like, we need to look at the people in our families who, in their own ways, fought for justice. You know, my mother has a grade school education. As you said, she migrated to the North from South Carolina, you know, where she experienced vicious racism and sexism and classism as a poor black woman. And she was forced to raise me by herself because of the irresponsibility of my father. And it was, you know, poverty is a form of violence. And that's what I grew up in. You know, I've had people say to me who've read the book already, they're shocked. You know, I said, well, you shouldn't be shocked because poverty is alive and well right here in New York, L.A., all over this country. You don't have to go overseas to do work. You can just turn to the communities that you live in. And you see poor people everywhere because there's still economic inequality rooted in this society. And that's what I grew up in. And you're right, you know, that scene with the library, which I made a chapter, was so important because my mother, you know, from I was 3 or 4 years old, she stressed to me that I had to get a quality education. She fought for it. I'm of the generation that went to those integrated schools right after the civil rights movement and all the work that was happening. And you know, you see the encounters we had with racism, yeah, going to those schools, but you also see my mother fighting and fighting. And the library represented something for her. She knew that she needed to put me in that space. My mother does not read books. She reads the local newspapers. Mm. And she watches the local news. But she let me roam, and that's how I discovered those books. And first it was sports books, and then, as you said, it became Ernest Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls. And it was life-saving, you know. And when you're poor, you know, and I still see the world through the eyes of working-class people because that's such a part of who I am. But that imagination was created because of the exposure to books. And then it was enhanced when I got to college, when I did discover who Alambre Brath was, and Patrice Lumumba, and Malcolm X, and all these different people. And I would listen to BAI as a teenager when I remember that well. And so you all were such a big part of my education, all the things that were happening in New York in the 80s and the early 90s. And, you know, I was deeply rooted in, you know, all the racial profiling cases we see today. I was out there, Howard Beach and Bensonhurst and, you know, all those different things. And, you know, for me, I never separated once I became aware. Being an artist from being an activist, it goes hand in hand. You have to do the work for the people. It's always about the people. And, you know, one thing I need to add is that, you know, part of the reason why I'm honest about the book, because I also think we need to talk about, you know, therapy, about counseling, about mental health, about pain, trauma. And just because you all of a sudden became an outcome an activist against racism or sexism or homophobia or classism, whatever your issue is, or the intersection of those issues, many of us carry around a lot of wounds, and you see it manifested in our movements and our organizations and our behavior patterns. And I said, man, we got to go in a different direction here. We've got to know how to be healthy, and that needs to be a part of the progressive mandate.
Well, including a path that you very clearly talk about that you could have gone down those frustrations. And that's where people don't realize that the intentions oftentimes may not be conscious, but they occur because of that imbalance. And what you said is because, you know, this poverty and the form of violence that it plays and then manifests and even repeats through young adults in their frustration. Yeah. So even after heading into college and still, you know, and also the other thing is the innocence of being a kid.
Yeah.
You know, we push the boundaries, you know, and now that's even more unbelievable to me, the reaction and the extreme excessive force against our youth by the police department I'm just generalizing, but oftentimes it's just a kid acting out and needing to find some boundaries, but not to be beat down
severely
that it reverses what the intention is, which is to, you know, educate and help a kid move forward and grow up.
That's right. You know, it's interesting to say that when I saw that scene of the young girl being beaten by the police officer in the classroom in South Carolina, I said to myself, you know, given the things I describe in my book about how I was an A student growing up, but I also, you know, had some issues, but I didn't deserve being beat up by the police officer when I was 15. I didn't deserve being told, you know, that I was going to, there was a principal in the fourth grade, my mother didn't tell me this until years later, who said I was going to end up out there on the streets with the rest of them, quote unquote. You know, this is the kind of stuff that, this is how we demonize our children, how we demonize working class poor children, especially children of color in the society. But I've seen it across the board with young people. And to me, young people and seniors, our elders, are our most most important resources in this community, in our community. But we treat them often as marginalized folks and don't value them, you know. And ultimately for me, you know, this book is about, you know, do we really value each other and love each other? Do we practice the love that Baldwin, James Baldwin talked about, that Dr. King talked about, you know, toward each other? You know, and I'm certainly including progressives in that. And I'm a lifelong progressive, you know, but we've got to start actually, in my opinion, being what we actually want to see in this world. We know what we're against. We can articulate that. You know, I've been every kind of activist, every kind of name, every kind of movement, as I've said earlier, you know, but I want to really get us to a point where we are really about healing and love as we do this work for social justice for all people.
Now we're coming to the close, Kevin, I swear I could sit and talk to you for ages.
Because
the parallel, too, of having this dialogue of our different, you know, what do they say, walk a mile in someone's shoes before you judge them. But just to read off some of the areas, you know, you talk about, I love the part with John Travolta and disco and then, of course, getting into college. But I'm going to leave this on a note of encouraging people to get the book. The book is entitled The Education of Kevin Powell. And do also check out BK Nation. The web address, again, is bknation.org. And find out more. And it truly is about building knowledge from all the knowledge that you have gained and shared with us. And thank you so much, Kevin. And we're definitely going to, this is the start of getting you back into the fold of WBAI.
Can I just mention that the event I'll be at tonight, if you don't mind?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. That was the whole, yeah. Please, please, please. You have readings here in New York tonight. You are at.
Yes, ma'am. I'm at MIST, M-I-S-T, at 46 West 116th Street between Lenox and between Malcolm X Boulevard and Fifth Avenue. That's MIST, 46 mm-hmm. West 116th Street tonight between Lenox or Malcolm X Boulevard and Fifth Avenue. It's at 7 p.m. It's free. It will actually be one of those community conversations, and we'll definitely have books for sale. And people can also email me at kevin at kevinpowell.net for more information. Kevin at kevinpowell.net.
Excellent.
Thank
and then
you
I know
so
another
much.
Reading coming up at the New Eureka Poets Cafe. And go to, kevinpowell.net.
Thanks so much, Kevin. We appreciate that. And look forward to reading your book and speaking.
Thanks, Kevin.
Speaking with you next
time.
Thank
you so much.
All right.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for us, Jeannie. We'll have to make way for other things. Democracy Now! Coming up next at 8 o'clock.
Is a statement from a WBAI local station board candidate. The views expressed are not those of WBAI management, staff, or current board. To view full candidate statements, visit www.elections.pacifica.org.
Hi, I'm James Sagerton, running for the local station board. As a WBAI volunteer and member of both the Finance Committee and the Community Advisory Board, I've seen firsthand what's up. Membership and donations are down. We're not reaching young people on the internet. We've lost millions in grants because one faction-run sister station hasn't completed required audits for years. Now, a new leasing agent for the Empire State Building seems unwilling to finish renegotiating our high antenna rent. So proposals to sell, swap, or lease our signal are flying around without any transparency for the listeners. I'll work with anyone to save WBAI, but the candidates I've seen doing the most to fix it are with the Elect Indy Caucus 2015. Vote James Sagerton. Vote Indy.
Warm greetings to BAI members. Mi más cordiales saludos a todos. I'm Dacio Quintana, running for the board with the Justice and Unity Campaign, endorsed by Pro Libertad and others, because we must strengthen this precious resource. I'm a retired teacher who's organized for years around social justice issues. I volunteer with the group Strategies for Social Change. At BAI, I've witnessed mismanagement and nastiness that have weakened the station. We need to implement a diversified fundraising plan using detailed proposals by Justice and Unity and others. We need more programming that conveys the activism of youth and our diverse communities. Please vote for the entire Justice and Unity slate. Visit justiceunity.org.
Stop members of the Pacifica National Board from selling WBAI. Pacifica and WBAI have lost more than $2 million because of the same board member's appointment of a CFO who failed to submit an audit. My name is Alex Steinberg. Years ago, I was a highly effective member of the Pacifica National Board. I know where the bodies are buried. I am running again so we could save WBAI and the Pacifica Network. Only the Indy Elect Caucus 2015 candidates are pledged to change the national board and management and save WBAI. If you want accountability, financial stability, progressive programming, and an end to cronyism, vote for me, Alex Steinberg. For more information, go to electindycaucus2015.org.
Hello, WBAI. My name is Bob Young, and I am an independent caucus member running for re-election
as a listener candidate on the local station board. For the past 3 years, I have served the listeners faithfully as chair and as vice chair with an almost perfect attendance record. The LSB is only empowered to certain tasks by the bylaws. I pledge to support them and not make false promises about what can and cannot be done. I support transparency and accountability in Pacifica and in WBAI. Please vote for me, Bob Young, and the whole Elect Indy Caucus 2015 team. Visit us at www.electindycaucus2015.org and at our Facebook page by the same name. Thank you.
The views expressed are not those of WBAI management, staff, or current board. To view full candidate statements, visit www.elections.pacifica.org.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Democracy Now! Is up next. Law and Disorder at 9 a.m.